Hi there, my name is John Paul Kermy. I am a breathwork teacher. I train people on how to teach breathwork as well. I'm really excited to be doing this new podcast with my good friend Feldy called Hangups, where we're going to help you change your life. We're going to show you how to transform your life with different tools.
That's right. I'm John Feldman. I'm in a band called Goldfinger. John Paul taught me breathwork. It changed my life. I have struggled with anxiety and depression throughout my life, and I've gotten through it. This is a solution-based show. We're talking about solutions to problems today.
All right, here we go, you guys. I'm super excited today to have my good friend Patrick Fabian on the podcast. Patrick is a fucking rad guy. He has been in the industry for like 20, 25 plus years, been on everything from Saved by the Bell and, you know, every guest star on NCIS. I mean, there's every guest star spot you can possibly do, Patrick has done. But you probably know him best for his role, his current role right now in Better Call Saul as Howard Hamlin, which he's amazing. He kills it in. That show is amazing. Did you know, Patrick, when you got that show, I mean, you had to have known when you got that show that this was going to be a game changer because of the built-in audience from Breaking Bad, right? I mean, you know that like everybody who loved Breaking Bad, which is the greatest show of all time, was going to watch Better Call Saul, right?
Well, you know, right. Patrick was in Breaking Bad, right?
No, I was not in it. No,
you weren't in it.
No, I'm not in it. Matter of fact, they talk about this. First of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. Second of all, I can't believe you glossed over me working with Angela Lansbury and Xena, but that's okay. We'll get back to that. Better Call Saul, it was an incredible job to get because I assume they would just give it to a movie star or something like that anyways. The thing with Saul is that I didn't even watch Breaking Bad by the time I auditioned for Better Call Saul because my wife was pregnant about 9 months with our first child when the pilot of Breaking Bad came out and we watched it and we finished the pilot. And my pregnant wife turns to me and she says, "Yeah, I'm not on board with this." And so we get a baby, we start dealing with the baby, we get a second baby, we deal with that baby. I managed to miss all of Breaking Bad because I'm raising these two small kids. We're going to bed early. And my wife has just said, "We're not going to do this." So I'm not watching it. And I see the billboards and I hear all about it, but I literally had not seen a single episode. So by the time I get an audition for it, I'm like, "Oh, well, it's Breaking Bad. I mean, they're going to get whoever they want." And this ties in, I'll try not to talk too much, but this ties into an actor's life in a nutshell. I wake up, I'm staring at the ceiling of a house that I finally bought over the age of 50, two kids, a wife, a freelance artist, and the phone isn't ringing. Everything that they told you in your 20s about how work dries up and nobody gives a shit if you're old comes crashingly true. No one is calling me. I can't get an audition. And I'm starting to get nervous that I finally put a financial commitment to be like a normal human being down. And I don't know what the fuck's gonna go on. I get a call from my manager. I'm very excited. It's an audition for Dog with a Blog on ABC Family. And I don't know if you know the show. The show is perfectly fine. The dog is number one on the call sheet. My friends are actually the parents on the show. But immediately I'm like, "Dog with a Blog? Don't you know who I think I am? Dog with a Blog?" And I get really screwed up about that. And then I'm like, wait. Then it dawns on me, this is the only thing they can find for me. My agents of 20 years, my manager of 24 years, this is the best they can do. We have all failed at our jobs at making me a star because this is the only opportunity that's there. I finally turned the whole car around in my brain because in the end, it turns out they pay American money and my mortgage also requires American money. So I get over myself. I put on my acting suit and I'm going to go down and I'm going to deign them with my presence. I show up at Dog with a Blog and there's no shit, 25 of me sitting in the waiting room. All of us of a certain age. Some of us have Emmys, not me. And I'm standing there and all of a sudden I get that cold, cold sweat that a freelance artist gets where you realize, did I make exactly the wrong choice in life? So I go into audition for Dog with a Blog and it's these young kids. I mean, they could be my kids in their 20s, it felt like. And they had backwards hats and McDonald's and they're staring at their phones. And I'm the old man in a suit with an 8x10 picture. I brought an 8x10. I'm so goddamn old. So I try and shake their hands. I start to do the audition. I feel shame. I'm just like, what am I doing here? The casting director says to me beforehand, I think her name is Elena Goldberg. God love her. And she's dressed up for the job and I'm there for the job. And she says to me without any hesitation, all right, when you're talking to the camera, you'll be talking here. And she points to the camera lens as if I don't know what that is. And then she says, I'll never forget this. And when you're talking to the dog, you'll be talking to me. She says with no irony and points to her own face. And I thought, you know, this is shameful for all of us. I could leave, but I don't, because I'm like, you know what? This is the job you chose. She showed up. I showed up. Let's do this. So 30 seconds into it of the dialogue, I get laughter in the room from the producers. Well, I'm so broken. That's all I need. Now I'm dancing like a monkey. We're having a grand old time. I finish the audition. I think this is great. I get out of the audition. I see all the other guys in the room. They give me stink eye. And I'm like, that's right, man. This dude just booked dog with a blog. And I get in the car and I call my manager, which I never do. And I say, hey, man, they're going to pin me on this. Then I start getting excited and thinking, you know what? This is great. My kids will be able to see me. They're going to pay me American money. I can pay my mortgage. It's a win-win-win. It's fantastic. Then I call my manager and he calls me by 5 o'clock and he says, guess what? You have a pin in you for dog with a blog. I'm like, fantastic. That's great. I know I'm going to get it. 5 days go by and I don't get a call at all. So I'm staring at the phone waiting for it to call. I finally call my manager and say, hey, what happened to dog with the blog? Did they forget my number? No, they didn't forget my number. He calls over to there and he calls back in 30 seconds and says, oh yeah, that's gone. They offered it to a name of your name and he hangs up. And I'm left at the age of 50 hearing that they had a name of your name offered to. And I feel ashamed for me, for the other 20 guys in the room. And I go, oh my God, I have chosen the worst business. The reason I tell that story in the detail is this. 2 weeks later, I get an audition for a show called Better Call Saul. As I told you, I had not seen Breaking Bad. So coming on the heels of Dog with the Blog, I go, oh, the sequel to Better Call Saul? Oh, they're not going to offer this to a name of your name.
Right.
You know? So I go in and I finally go, okay, I'm going in. Why? Because I haven't seen the casting directors, Sherry Thomas and Sherry Bialy. Haven't seen them in about 4 or 5 years. That's the way it goes in the business. And I'm like, oh, great. I have an opportunity to go see them. They also cast The Walking Dead. Walking Dead at this point is probably season 3 or 4. And I think, ooh, I'm going to go in and audition for this Better Call Saul thing, but I'm going to show them that I'm really good because I haven't seen them in a while. And then they're going to give me like a 3-episode arc on The Walking Dead. And then I'll get eaten by a zombie. That was my goal. So I go in for the audition. I sit down with Sherry Thomas. We exchange niceties. It's just her, an iPhone, and me. She gives me this note. She says, by the way, these guys at Breaking Bad, they like it real. I'm like, great, I got that. I can hear that. I begin to then audition as if I'm in a Greek theater outside. I'm shouting. I'm blasting through the back wall to some parking lot. I finish the audition. She looks at me and she gives me the exact same note and says, they really like it real. After 26 years of auditioning, something in my reptilian actor brain goes, you didn't listen to her. Do something different. So I sort of release everything. The dog with the blog, the whole Breaking Bad, the whole Walking Dead. And I'm like, fuck, I'm just a piece of shit. And I just speak and talk and listen. She says, thank you. And I drive home. And on the way home, I do what actors always do. I repeat my audition to the steering wheel. And the steering wheel says, yeah, it's not bad. Maybe you have a chance. I don't hear anything for 3 weeks. And 3 weeks later, I get a call. And my manager says, Vince Gilligan saw your tape. And they want to test you for the role of Howard Hamlin. And I go, really? And he said, yeah, really. And I said, well, we both shouldn't be surprised, but we both were. Literally 5 days later, I go to Sony, I test. And then 2 days later, I get a call and I get the job. And for me, in terms of a game changer, all the way back to your original question, the game changer is this. I didn't become a better actor in the 2.5 weeks between not getting Dog with the Blog and getting Better Call Saul. It just reminded and reinforced to me that you've got to show up. You got to suit up and show up to your opportunities. And then you have to let it out of your hands. You can only do what you can do. And what I can do is show up and show these particular people at this particular time, this actor is going to act this particular role like this. I hope it's the answer to the question that you have, which is, who is this character? Sometimes I'm the answer, sometimes I'm not. Yeah. And in this case, I was glad that I was not the answer for Dog with the Blog, although at the time I would have said something different. And I was the answer to being Howard Hamlin. That is a long opening story. If anybody's still listening, I apologize. It won't get any better.
It's a great story. I love what you said. You went over it quick and a lot of listeners probably didn't catch it, which you said the dog was at the top of the call sheet. And the way it works in the TV or movie industry is there's a call sheet that goes out every morning. And who's ever at the top of it is the top dog, in other words, is the most important person on that set, the most important person on that movie. And the dog was the most important person on that show.
Well, I mean, he had a blog. He knew how to type, so I guess he could work his way around Google or something.
I mean, this has to be a game changer for you, though. This show, I mean, has put you in front of so many people, and you're so good on it, and incredibly talented. And I have to think, like, you've done some movies too in between seasons, right? You did what was it, the Driver movie? What's that movie?
Yeah, I did some independent films. I mean, in terms of game changer, you know, it's that whole thing. I don't think there is any overnight success. Even the people who hit young have put a lot of time into it. I mean, we love that story of like, and then all of a sudden they became so-and-so. And
yeah, you're discovered at 7-Eleven. It never happens.
Yeah, I that's a rare story, although we like it. It's apocryphal and also gives everybody hope that I can do that. And that may be the case. You know, I went to college. I went to graduate school for theater, for God's sakes. And then I started waiting tables because nobody cared that another actor had showed up in Los Angeles. And I hung around to get my breaks. But basically, I've freelanced job to job for, 25 years. I've shot like 13 pilots. None of them have ever gone. And this is the first series regular job that I've ever had after a quarter of a century in the business. So in terms of game changer, the thing that changes it, I don't get the, I call it the St. Louis airport thing. I've been like in the airport in St. Louis walking through the terminal and people will stop you and they'll go, "Hey, I know you. Didn't I go to high school with you?" And you're like, "I don't know. Did you go to Central Pennsylvania?" And they're like, "No, no, that's not it." So now I'm sort of caught because I know what they're talking about. And I offer it up. I'm like, "Oh, well, I'm an actor. So you might know me from that." They go, "Oh, that's what it is." And they go, "What do I know you from?" Now I'm standing in the St. Louis airport. And again, my ego and my emotional hole is so big and broken that I'm willing to now go through my resume with some stranger to satisfy their curiosity that they kind of think they know me. And as you pointed out, I don't know, is it from CSI? Is it from Star Trek? Is it from Xena? Is it from Friends? Is it from Saved by the Bell? Is it from Disney movies? So I start going down. And when you start doing that, you're caught. So I'm like, is it Star Trek? They're like, "No, that's not it." I'm like, "Is it Friends? No, that's not it." Finally, we'll hit on something. And they're like, "Oh yeah, you were the dude in the thing." And then we part ways. Now when I'm in the airport, people just shout out directly, "Hey, Howard, get off Kim's back." Stuff like that. So I'll take that any day.
It must be so painful if you're having a bad day to have to, go through that experience. You know, I have a lot of actor friends and I've been out with them in public situations and people handle it differently. You know, different actors handle it very differently. And it's so awkward, it can be so awkward, but I think you're the type of guy that is very gracious. And I feel like that, but like when you're having that shitty day, when you're having a bad day and somebody like corners you in an airport or a Starbucks, I mean, I don't know how you muster it up. I really don't.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. People handle it differently and however they want to handle it, by the way, is their personal business. Just because they've decided to be a performer doesn't mean they owe when they're not performing any sort of behavior. I believe that. And I don't, but I also come from the school of thought of like, I've chosen to put myself in the public eye. And the fact of the matter is my life gets to exist because people respond to shows I've been on. And so if somebody's going to take the time out to feel personal with me because I've been in their living room, right? Or I've been in the fabric of their life for 20 years as, the bad guy on a drama or something. I feel like it's the least I can do unless it's really intrusive. And most people aren't really intrusive. Most people are gracious about that sort of thing. Like if I'm eating dinner at a restaurant, that's a different thing. And I'll always be like, can we do this later? Or if I'm around afterwards, I'll seek you out sort of thing. But for the most part, I take it as part and parcel. It's show business. It's show business. You want to get my office to get a selfie because your daughter saw Twitches 10 years ago? Sure. That sounds fine to me. Because if you look at it mercenarily as well, it might make the difference between you tuning into a show that I'm on later on that I want to be successful. right? Or a movie, or as you pointed out, I did some independent films. You know, how are you going to get people to the turnstiles or to stream it? I don't know. You get people who think fondly of you and go like, well, I'll give a shot at this movie because this guy stopped in the airport one day and said hi. And you just don't know the power of television. You know, Saul's a big hit and it's worldwide. And that's really fun. And I get a lot of requests on social media for people in certain situations. People who maybe, for instance, people who have television as their only outlet to the outside world because of either sickness or a disability and such like that. And, you know, who am I to be the asshole to be like, I'm not going to make you a 30-second video to say, get well, please. You know, people reach out all the time to say, my dad's a big fan, but there's no way he would ever, you know, reach out to you. Can you say something? And I enjoy that engagement. That part of like social media aspect is great. So that's cool. But and anybody who's listening, if you start flooding me with saying, send me my dog or pictures of me and my children, probably not happening.
You know, what's interesting to me is like when I saw you on Friends a couple of weeks ago, which I've seen that episode, the 100th episode, a bunch. It's like my daughter, who's 12, is fucking obsessed with Friends. And it's like there's this resurgence of that show that's beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And it's like, you know, because I'm from the 90s, you know, ultimately like most of my success in my band were from the 90s. And there's so many things that my young little daughter just turned 12 is like, Daddy, what's a hooker? Because of Friends, like, you know what I mean? And like, Daddy, why is it bad that they're gay? And it's like all these things that these jokes that happened back then. It's just interesting. Like, and I bet you do get recognized more on Friends now than maybe even then, because it's had such a resurgence.
Absolutely. And Friends that's a really great point it was a massive hit back in the day, obviously. And it's even more massive now because of Netflix. You know, we have babysitters who came over to our house pre-pandemic, and we would come home and they would be watching Friends. And I was like, I finally asked them, like, what's the attraction? And the attraction I finally drilled down to was, one, they all were friendly. Nobody was snarky and really mean to one another. They had problems, but they ended up being friends. It was a safe play. It's a safe show where it's girls and guys figuring stuff out. Everyone eventually becomes all friends, and nobody's mean, nobody's getting shot, nobody's dying of an overdose. All the real world corrosiveness that kids get on a daily basis doesn't exist in the world of Friends. And I think we've always talked about the idea of, you know, they have the best apartment in the world with the worst jobs in New York City, which is kind of amazing. But I get recognized it all the time because of Nurse Dan. And that was one single episode out of 10 years of a television show. And I get hit up on that all the time. I mean, granted, I mean, let's be honest, I had really beautiful hair then. There's no doubt about that.
You still have great hair, brother. Yeah, you know what's interesting about your story is they say don't leave before the miracle happens, right? I mean, I've heard that expression so much in my life. And the idea, I have three kids, and I live with, you know, two of them, and I've got a wife that doesn't work, and I'm self-supporting, like we talk about, through my own contributions. And, you know, I used to be a shoe salesman. And I mean, how often do you think when you're going on that audition for Dog with a Blog and you're just like, this is my fucking make it or break it moment to pay the mortgage? Like, how often do you go to that space of like, and what do you do? Like, how do you combat that? Like, what are your tools to combat that fear of like, fuck, am I going to pay the bills?
Yeah, no, you know what? That has been since I quit waiting tables back in 1992 because I got my first pilot job, which at the time, well, by any stretch of the imagination, was a lot of money. I think it was $9,000. Mm-hmm. Which was, you know, 1992, that's still a lot of money. But it was enough to go quit my waiting tables job, because at that point in my brain, I thought, oh, well, I've gotten a pilot on a television show and it seemed like it was going to be picked up, right? It had Kathy Kinney in it and Judge Reinhold, and it was really funny. And everybody around me, all the executives, they all said, this is great. And I believed everything that was being said to me. So without anybody telling me, I just went and quit my waiting tables job. I was like, I'm done. and did not get picked up. And all of a sudden I was an unemployed actor who quickly went through that $9,000 was really like $4,000 after taxes and everything else. And that was gone quickly. And I was like, what am I going to do? And my friend said, well, I guess it's time for you to get another acting job. And that thought had not occurred to me that the experience of being a freelance worker is that you get a job, but that job has an end. And then you have to go get another job. So the cycle is about how do you keep yourself sane in between jobs, because when your job ends, you always think you're never going to work again. And you hear this from actors all the way back to like a Laurence Olivier, the older English actor people might know. He talked about getting stage fright before going on, throwing up before going on opening night. And you're like, why would he be like that? Because he's nervous, because he's got a skin in the game, because it matters. And in the same respect, you're bummed out when you don't have a gig because you're like, I've got a skin in the game. It's what I do. I have to wait for other people's permission to do the thing I love to do. So what do I do in between? Well, over 25 years of a lot of things, you know, I used to drink and drug is what I used to do to make myself feel better. And that did not work for me. As a matter of fact, that worked very poorly for me. And it drug me down and made me even worse off. I finally got to get sober around 40 years old. And by the way, this is not I'm not the old man trying to piss on your party. You want to do what you want to do, go and do what you do. But I can tell you from experience for myself, it did not work for me. And I never stayed at a party late and got a job. And I never went home with the girl and got a gig, but I certainly showed up hungover at an audition and didn't get the job. And I certainly surrounded myself with lower companions that didn't want to lift me up in a tough business. That was my experience. So if there's anybody listening out there who finds that drinking and drugging isn't quite helping improve their quality of life, I can tell you that I hear you, and it doesn't have to be that way. And this is not a giant advertisement. It's just, it's my own personal experience. The arts are hard enough, and it's filled with people who wear their hearts on their sleeve, right? We have that big hole in the middle of their chest that you're saying, please applaud for me. Tell me that I'm good. I mean, that's just a truism throughout the centuries. It doesn't stack your deck in the favor if you're kneecapping yourself with drugs and alcohol. That's my personal opinion about it. You can make your own decisions about it. But along the way, even when I was doing that, I would find things like not comparing myself, the grass being greener. You know, it's FOMO, they call it now, right? But, you know, I auditioned for Friends for the role of Chandler. I auditioned for George Clooney's role in ER. I didn't get those. And I watched those people get on the cover of Rolling Stone and become millionaires and become worldwide famous. What do you do with that when you're 26 and 27? How do you compartmentalize that in yourself to make yourself feel okay? Well, it's hard. The whole world, no matter what business you're in, is all about comparison. And all comparison leads to sorrow, man. So what are you going to do? Well, I'll suggest meditation. I'll suggest getting into nature. I'll suggest living one day at a time and being happy with what you've got. You want to play the FOMO game. Play the FOMO game where, you know, people don't have a roof. People can't eat. People don't have a job. And that's hard. That's the whole, oh, they're hungry in China argument you get in the dining room table and all the movies with your dad. But there is truth to that. And over 25 years of sort of working in the business of auditioning and not getting the gig, I have to remind myself that there's always an opportunity the very next day. The very next day, there's an opportunity where literally the phone can ring. And I think that's a metaphor for anybody's life. An event can occur and something can change that will shift your perspective in the way that you live and shift the way that your life is actually going. I mean, you can make the argument that one, Friends wouldn't have been Friends if Patrick Fabian got the job, because the chemistry would have been not the same thing, right? The right people got those jobs. And the same respect that the right person here got those jobs. And there's plenty of jobs out there. They're just not all for you. But I think as a human and as an actor, this actor at least, I'm always crushingly disappointed that I didn't get 99 of the jobs that I auditioned for. And then when I get that 100th job, I managed to make it a turd salad by going like, well, yeah, I got this, but I didn't get. Let me tell you about all the shit that didn't happen to me, all the money I didn't make, all the girls I didn't sleep with. Who wants to be around that guy? Well, that guy was in my head for the longest time. And if you don't like being around with your own self, you got to figure out a way of making it okay. I thought I was going to be a rock and roll star. I thought I was going to be like, I don't know, Keanu Reeves or Brad Pitt. Well, it turns out those roles were taken. They're occupied by Keanu Reeves and Brad Pitt, and they're doing a very fine job of it. It turns out my rock and roll lifestyle ended up being living in the valley with two dogs and being married, and happily so. happy to be alive and happy to be able to tell a story about getting an opportunity to be on Dog with a Blog, because most people don't even get the opportunity.
Do you think it's easier or harder now that you're sober to handle that disappointment? You know, do you have more tools? I mean, you have more tools, I'm sure, and we can go into the tools, but I found that, you know, now that I'm sober, my thing with booze or drugs was to numb out that pain of disappointment, to numb out that, like, I didn't get the part, I didn't get the, they didn't buy my screenplay, they didn't, you know, this didn't happen. And so now that I'm sober, I have to feel those feelings, right? And feeling those feelings is a fucking beast sometimes.
It's hard. And you're right, all of a sudden it does become, well, it helps remind me that, you know, just because I got the job doesn't make me king of the world. And just because I didn't get the job doesn't mean I'm a bad actor.
Right.
And that took a long time. Instead, it was all or nothing, right? If I got the job, then I'm great. Fuck you. I couldn't find any humility. I couldn't find my place in the world because it was constantly up and down and up and down and up and down. But being sober makes it more aware of not getting the gig, because I am aware of the ramifications of that, and of like, oh, I didn't get friends. Oh no, that means I'm not this, this, and this. But it also gives me the ability to say, let's really look at this list of things you think you didn't get. I find, well, not surprisingly, my auditions got better. You know, I got sober at 40. So I'd been working for almost 20 years, almost 18 years of a career in spite of myself, one could say. And if I could play the game of like, if I hadn't have been that, would I have been? But that's nonsense to like live in the past for anybody in anybody's life, I think.
How long have you been sober now?
14 and a half years.
Good for you. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, it's amazing and it's a miracle. And the reason I stay sober is because it's better, you know, being sober. This is a cliche, but it's true. My worst day sober is still better than my best day drunk. It really is, because I can feel all of it and things are good. I got sober and started auditioning, and my managers and agents started getting feedback like, wow, Patrick is, I don't know what happened, but he's really good. Boy, it's good to see Patrick back, or stuff like that. And, you know, it's... you start hearing that and you go, oh, and I think part of it is because I could actually, you know, acting is talking and listening. Acting is all about being present and soaking in the moment in a realistic fashion. And, you know, if you're numb, you're just putting a wall literally between you and the person who's talking to you. So I wasn't surprised. I got nervous. I got nervous about being on set. I got nervous about all this, because all of a sudden it dawned on me how grateful, which, you know, being sober has also given me an ability to be grateful for the things that I have. It's not a right that I get to be on set or audition. You know, you don't get a right to do that. I'm lucky that I get the opportunity to do so, that people are willing to pick up the phone on my behalf to get me in there. So when you get on set, it's like, wow, how lucky am I? I get to be working in an industry that I love. That's a very tough industry to be in the first place. And you know, that sounds cloying. I'm going to vomit. Oh my God. You know, Pollyanna. That's okay. But my experience is that's that. The people who don't treat it like that, I find themselves drummed out of the business, because it's a hard business to be in. And nobody likes to work with assholes. Yeah. Granted, plenty of assholes have rocketed to the top and continue to do what they do. But for the most part, I find that people who are there are grateful to be there. So I'm sort of veered off the course on that. But, you know,
I guess, you know, being sober allows me to be present and open to opportunities that, like, if I was locked in my apartment, you know, hungover, or just not, I don't know. I'm just, everything that's come along in my life has been a result of me being able to show up and just to be present. And I love your story about that audition, how you thought it was going to go one way. You know, I produced a record for this band that went horribly south, and they fired me after about 2-3 months of work. And I did all this stuff on spec, and it ended up that the singer just really went off the rails and ended up in prison for most of his life, you know. And I was going to be, what I thought was going to be this record to change my life, ended up being, my name's not on this record. thank God it's not on this record. And then 2 weeks later, I was in London and I met this band 5 Seconds of Summer, just because I was there, just randomly happened. And I was able to kind of like grow those kids into these huge superstars. And had I not been available sober, you know, ready, you know, you're in London after 2 days, you're all fucked up, jet lag and all that, you know, but I'm there. I'm able to be there. And that's what you say. You show up and you do the best you can. You prepare, you work your ass off. And part of it for me, the drive is still like, I don't want to go back to selling shoes. And my drive is still there. I remember what it's like to clock in and have to show up in time and have a boss that's like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, whatever. I don't ever want to go back there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, even though I haven't waited tables in what, 20 some years, the idea of like, you know, look, especially the pandemic also, you know, reminds everybody that, you know, nothing is in stone. Many events can happen that affect everything and everything gets shut down. The only reason that I'm not in a complete panic now is because I was smart enough to save money along the way, knowing that I'm freelance, knowing that there's not a gravy train all the time, knowing that I did not want to have to go back and get quote unquote a straight job because I hadn't had one in a long time. So I squirreled away money. I lived close to the bone and I didn't overextend myself, you know? And so therefore, when this all hit, I was able to tighten up and be okay. I don't know how long that gets to last as we struggle through this, but certainly a driving factor of, you know, staring at the roof of my house, finally committing to a house, finally committing to the idea of like, all right, I'm going to be responsible for kids and all of that. And then literally I ran into a patch where I hadn't worked for the longest time in my career. And then all of a sudden you start going, oh no, what's the plan? And the plan is to keep your shit together because the phone will ring and you need to go and keep your shit together when you get in front of an audition. Because the last thing you want to show anybody is, I need this job, I'm desperate. Because that comes through more than anything, whether you like it or not. If you come in, you're like, I need this. Oh my God. Oh my God. People have a reptilian sense and they're like, well, we like what he did, but there's something, and they'll go with the person who's more comfortable in their own skin. So closer you can get comfortable in your own skin, whenever you're in those situations, the better. Freak out on your own time, I guess is the advice there.
Yeah, I've been going through it a little bit, you know, because I sort of had to pivot a few times in my life and I found this breathing thing, which has changed my life. And then I got, it blew up for me eventually, blew up. It took 8 years, but so it took 8 years and I got there. And then I was doing classes with 250 people in the room and my classes are sold out weeks in advance when I come to Los Angeles. My trainings are sold out. And guess what? None of that's fucking happening right now. There's no classes. There's no live classes. There's no live trainings. Luckily, I'm doing it online on Sundays and I have online courses. Thank God. And like you said, I saved money. I put money away. I'm fine. You know, I don't know when people are going to breathe in a room together. Maybe not for another year, at least, you know? So I have to be okay with that and be like, okay, this is not what I had planned. This is not what I want right now. But what am I going to do? And so I've had to dig back into the tools to like finding different things, whether it's breath work or I stepped up my meditation game. And Feldy and I talk about all these tools on the show, like, you know, doing cold plunge, cold showers, I have a float tank, I have an infrared sauna, I have all this shit, like anything I can buy that's going to make me feel better or like make me feel like shit, but then I'm going to feel better afterwards. Like, what is that? Electric shock therapy? Is there a home electric shock therapy? I'll buy it right now and put it on my brain. And then if I feel great afterwards, I'm like, I'll call Feldy. And I'm like, you got to try this electric shock therapy, Feldy. It's amazing. And he'll be like, where do I order it? And like, that's what this show is kind of about. Like all this crazy shit that we do because we want to feel better. And so we're trying to share that with people. So do you have any crazy shit that you do or not crazy stuff or anything that you want to share that you think could help somebody out there?
Well, I mean, first of all, you immediately helped me spend. I'm getting on Amazon immediately, looking up all this stuff. Nothing I like better than spending money on something. That's for sure. There's so
I got a few things I can send your way that you'd like. The light glasses are crazy with the.
I'll try anything. I'm open to anything. As a matter of fact, I've got one of those upside down hangy things. It's the V shape. What do you call it? Inversion
table. Yeah, good for your back. You haven't tried my breath work yet, though, have you?
What's that?
You haven't tried my breath work yet. We have to get you into a class.
I'll should call me out because I made a couple of appointments to show up and then I didn't. So talk about
okay. We'll get you.
I'll be first in line when the pandemic rolls off. They're going to shoot me up with a vaccine and I'll come. I'll be the first to come breathe. We'll live podcast it.
I'll send you a link to my Sunday morning class, which even if you can't make it, you can do the replay for about 4 or 5 days after. So
all right.
You can do it in your own time. But tell me about what you do. Like, what do you have a meditation practice? What are you into?
Well, yeah, my children are 8 and 10. And like I said, I've got a wife, 2 dogs, and my niece lived with me, and so does my sister-in-law. So finding room to meditate becomes very tricky. I do about 5 minutes a day, and it's mostly like the sort of sit up in the bed first thing in the morning. That's what I try to do. I try and not reach for the phone. I try and not get online and let somebody else dictate what's going on. But for me, I like to get active. I ride my bike almost every day. I get to the ocean 3 to 4 times a day. Getting to the, I'm lucky that I live in Los Angeles and it takes about 30 to 40 minutes to get out to the beach. And I get out to the beach and I swim. I get in the ocean and I swim for half an hour. And we've been playing volleyball at a certain spot for like 20 years. And so we still, except when the beaches were closed, we would go out and be spatial, you know, be spaced away, safe distance. But, you know, you get in the ocean, and I would spend, you know, 3-4 hours in the ocean on Saturdays and Sundays. And that is enough to like really get me going. Also, the hills of Los Angeles are great for hiking. So I get out there. I need to get out. Like I said, my kids are 8 and 10. So I take them biking and we go roller skating, which is, I think, fun for them. Although, of course, all I'm doing is saying, watch out, stop at the stop sign, look for cars. They're not looking for you. So maybe it's not as fun as I think it is for them. But, you know, I need to move. I need to get the body involved because meditation is hard for me. I got the squirrel brain, the monkey mind, and all those things I think people out there are familiar with. And so it really takes a super dedication for me to do it. I've got the apps. I've got the music. I can burn incense. I love the accoutrements. I love the setup of the scene, but the fucking scene sometimes is really hard for me to do. The scene is sitting and being quiet. The scene is actually quieting the mind, allowing your thoughts to be what they are. The river afloat, right? Let them move. Observe them. Let them go down. It's hard for me. My wife likes to try and meditate with me, but then all I do is sit there and think about being married, which is good and bad, you know? And so that gets me out of it. So solo meditation is for me. Do you guys do any sort of group meditation either with your spouses or your kids ever?
Dude, my wife has no interest whatsoever in meditating or prayer or any of that shit. She likes to drink tea and go shopping. So, and I love her to death. I love my wife to death, but she has no interest in any of it. I meditate, you know, I do breath work and it's all, I mean, sometimes when I have a songwriting session, we'll do breath work before the session, maybe once, twice a week, I'll do that, which is cool. As a group, I feel like it's more powerful. I feel like when I'm with a group of people in prayer, it's more powerful than when I'm on my own. So I definitely believe in that power of being with people, you know, since I've been doing most of my business meetings and all my meetings are online now. It's just, it's not the same. The energy just isn't the same. I don't get goosebumps as much when I come up with a great, you know, melody or lyric. It's just, it's not the same unless I'm with someone.
Yeah.
There is a layer of that's, we're connected right now, but there's a layer of it's, I don't want to say it's disconnection, but it's a layer in between us. You know, it's not the same thing. You don't feel that person's energy like you do in person. And, you know, I'm doing my classes online and I can see the people in the little boxes in the Zoom chat, in the Zoom thing. When I do the classes online, I can see them reading and I can see them getting emotional and crying like they do in my breathwork class. And you, when I'm doing that class in person, I start getting caught in it. I feel their tears. I feel their energy and I start getting caught in it. And so I'm not getting as emotional as I do in a live in-person class, but it still works. And it works for these people who are doing it with me online and it works for me. I feel amazing after I lead a class. You know, I have to get out of myself and help somebody else, whether it's teaching them breath work or, you know, helping them get sober or whatever. I have to get out of myself and help somebody else. I think there's something really powerful in salt water. You were talking about getting in the ocean. Like I have this float tank and the float tank has 800 pounds of Epsom salt in it. But I think there's some thing that actually happens to our bodies when we're floating in salt water. It's really powerful. It's really incredible. And they say it's like, you know, whatever, fucking negative ions or discharging, you know, grounding. Like they have this thing called grounding where you go out and put your feet in the dirt. You know, I don't really do it, but it's supposed to do something for you. It's supposed to do something for your body. I mean, I'm like, you know, I'm willing to try anything. Patrick, like you were talking about, I couldn't get my head to sit still. And that's why when I found breath work, I was like, oh, this isn't meditation. This is a workout. Like you lay there and you breathe in this intense way, like a workout. And then your brain shuts off, like I did 18 Vicodin, and it shuts off in this incredible way. And I feel connected to my heart and things I've never felt. And I felt a connection to God the first time I did it. You know, I don't really say that too often. It was the first time I ever felt that. And it was as real as wanting to fucking punch someone on the 405 freeway. It was that undeniable. It was real. And then I immediately called Feldy and I was like, you have to tie this breathing thing. Like, I'm going to come take you through this breathing thing. It's crazy. And I thought like I was going to tell the world. And like, I'm like, how does everybody not know about this? There's like, so it took me down a rabbit hole of all this weird woo woo shit. Cause I was like, what else is out there? If this is that incredible, like what else is out there? And I've done a lot of weird stuff, but still nothing is as powerful as the breath work that I've found yet. And the key I think is just to have an open mind, you know, to just be willing to be like, okay, I'm going to go to a class and pay somebody and they're going to tell me how to fucking breathe. Like, that's so stupid. Okay. I'll do it anyways. Like everything I do is like, oh, that sounds so dumb. Let's go, you know? And, it's like hanging out with Feldy. Feldy's like, oh, we're going to go to this haunted house. I'm like, okay. And the next thing I know, I've got a guy's got a plastic bag over my head and I'm crawling through a fucking tunnel and some guy's trying to like make me lick his nipple. I'm like, this is not a normal haunted house, Feldy. Like Feldy goes to haunted houses, which are on another level. I had PTSD. I didn't even know what PTSD was until I went to this haunted house with Feldy, where this guy tried to make me lick his nipple and we were crawling through a fucking tunnel. And it was crazy. I was fucked up for like 3 days. He's so got this good, weird obsession. Talk about this. Those
actors are so good in that haunted house, man, that blackout. You know what I wanted to ask you, Patrick, is, you know, you've reached, you know, obviously you've had these peaks and valleys in your career like we all do. You know, it's not like all wins. Is there ever a moment in your life where you just sit back and just go, you know what? Good job, buddy. You did okay. And give yourself a break. Or are you always looking, what's next? What's next?
Wow. I would like to think I'm the guy who does that all the time. I'm not broken so much that I can't recognize my own good fortune. And now that I've gotten to a certain age and I have a lengthy body of work behind me, there's sort of an undeniability that I have, quote unquote, been a success. I've been a working actor in a very tough business for 25 years. That alone makes me a winner. Whether I've saved my money or, you know, have a castle up in the Hollywood Hills doesn't even matter. Or whether I'm a movie star. In terms of like giving back, let's see. The reason I'm saying, my university, Penn State University, contacted me and they wanted me to like come back and talk to the kids. And I've talked to the kids back there and they are kids, they're 18. And I found myself back in the old room where I first started taking acting class. And I thought, oh, this is that cycle of life stuff that Shakespeare talked about and Aeschylus and, you know, Aristophanes wrote about and they still write about. Neil Simon writes about. And it's discovering that the music that you really loved is now on the oldie station and you never thought you'd been there. And so I'm in that spot now where people are like, well, what was it like to work with Xena? Or who's Angela Lansbury? You know, I referenced Laurence Olivier earlier in this, and I thought, you know, I had to sort of qualify who that might be because I realized everything fades. It all, you know, goes. You know, all things must pass, as they say, as George Harrison pointed out. And so consequently, I don't want to ruin the here and now and all my hard work and all my success by saying it's not enough. It's got to be more. Now, do I have ambition? Do I want to do other things? Absolutely. But when I start checking off the variety of stuff that I've been able to do, which in retrospect took me a long time to appreciate, that's made me for a really full life. I've done independent films. I've shot in the sewers of Los Angeles. I've shot on a catamaran off of Ibiza. You know, I've worked in Mexico and Vancouver and New Zealand. And I've been on a hit show and I've been on shit shows. I've worked with Screech, Monkees, and the Olsen Twins. I mean, honest to God, how much more does a man really want in this business? That's really the truth. And the fact of the matter is, though, but then I go, yeah, but I'm not. And that goes back to that whole FOMO thing. You know what? I bet you Brad Pitt also is maybe a little mad and jealous of Tom Cruise. I'm going out on a limb. And the only reason I say that is because I remember hearing Dustin Hoffman say once something about, like, you're always in line. I think that was the quote. Somebody was interviewing him and they said, you know, you've got this and you've got this and this. And he just shushed them. And he goes, no, you're always in line. There's always somebody in front of you in line. Doesn't matter where you are in line. There's somebody in front of you and you're kind of pissed off about it. And he goes, if you're not, then you don't have the ambition required to sustain a career. He goes, what he thought. And I thought, right. So it's always to acknowledge that there's somebody else in front of you in line. And it's not them that's in the way. It's the thing they represent. You know, if I just had this, then I'll be okay. Well, really? Because then when you get this, we have a zillion stories of, I got the girl, I got the house, I got the money, and then it all cascades and pisses away. So, you know, be careful what you wish for. There's another cliche, because you just might get it. And if you can't be happy with what you got, you're never going to be happy with what you get. So all that stuff as well. I'm healthy. As you would, you know, I'm as healthy as an alcoholic drug addict for 20 years could be at 55. I have a roof over my head. I got food on my plate today. My kids are relatively nice. They're loud as shit, but that's okay. I got a piano that I'm starting to learn to play. I get to ride my bike and swim in the Pacific Ocean. Even though the country's on fire politically and emotionally and the world is in a worldwide pandemic, I am okay today. And if I can wrap my head around that, if I can appreciate just that, then I can have a good day. If I want to do the other math, I can make today awful. And I can make each successive day worse and worse and worse. But which doesn't say that I still don't want to be the sheriff in a Western, which doesn't say that I don't want to be a lead in a series that's really successful, which doesn't mean that I don't want to be on Broadway someday. All those things are out there. And they're maybes, because the phone might ring tomorrow or even later today that will set in action the events that will lead me to that thing. And to your point earlier, Phil, you got to be open to that. You got to be open to what's coming up and what's going on. But for fuck's sake, if, you know, like I said, if you can't work with the Olsen twins and not be happy with your acting career, then, sir, you've got a problem.
All right. So we do a little questionnaire sort of towards the end here. And I'm going to ask you some questions and you can pass on any of these that you want. Right. Or you can answer them. What's sure. The scariest thing that's ever happened to you, or what are you most afraid of?
Oh, scariest thing that's ever happened to me. I was flying in turbulence going into Denver, and I thought I was going to die. And the lack of control and all that stuff. And there was like maybe a 6-year-old kid or a 7-year-old kid was sitting beside me with this teddy bear, and I was clearly freaking out. He handed me this teddy bear, and he grabbed my hand, and he said, "It's always like this going home." Because he was from Denver. But I was freaked out. I took his bear, and I would have taken his clothes and all of his money if that would have made me feel better.
Did you start to pray? Because I've had a couple flights like that where I literally started to pray.
Oh, it's just like, it wasn't even the bargaining. It was just like, oh, I'm going to die. So what's going on? What's going on? Please help me. Help me. Help me get to wherever the next thing is.
What's your most embarrassing moment? You can pass if you want.
No.
I want to know what just came up now. Like,
oh, you know what? You know what? I woke up in one of the fanciest hotels I'd ever been to, with a girl who I just started dating, and the bed was soaked with my own urine because I was too lazy to get out of bed, and I peed the bed, and we both had to pretend like it didn't happen.
I've had that moment, except there was no pretending. There was like, that was you. And I'm like, no, it wasn't. No, it was denial. That's not my pee. That's your pee. What? What superpower?
I definitely wasn't at the fanciest hotel I've ever been at. But yeah, I used to just have the mattress. There was just the mattress on the floor. No sheets, no anything. And oh God, this girl had her period on the bed. So there was definitely the next morning. And it was like, and that bloodstain stayed there for months before I stopped drinking. God, and now I'm like complaining to my wife. I'm like, we didn't get the big enough suite at the Montage. Like, what are you talking? Like, my life is so different now.
Crazy. I have a buddy that peed himself in the movie theater. He passed out. And like, when we were all walking out, he had peed himself, peed the movie chair. Oh, okay. What superpower would you like to have and most like to have, and why?
Oh, I would like to fly, even though I know it with bugs in your mouth and everything else. I'd love to be able to fly.
Okay. If you could make up a rule or a law that everyone had to follow, what would it be?
No one's allowed to shout when they're talking to one another.
You would never survive in my house growing up. That's all. The only way the Krimis talk is they shout over each other. My wife was like, "What? Why is everybody yelling at each other at the dinner table?" I'm like, no, that's just how we talk. That's how it is. What character from a TV show or a movie do you dislike the most?
Do I dislike? Oh, wow. Well, you know, I love Sean Connery in The Man Who Would Be King. That's the reason I became an actor.
That's great. That's great. And what role would you most like to have played? That one?
Oh, yeah. And there's no way I'll ever play something like that, most likely. I mean, he's Sean Connery. There's certain things that you know what you're not. You know, I'm not playing Iago anytime soon. I tell you what, if Iago needs a lawyer, or if The Man Who Would Be King needs a lawyer from the main line in Philadelphia to come down on the train and deliver papers, I'm your guy.
But when I was an actor and doing method, I did Meisner. My thing was like Kenneth Branagh and, you know, Henry V, where he does the St. Crispin's Day speech, you know, he does the whole St. Crispin's Day. It's the greatest. It's one of the greatest monologue, that monologue and Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross.
Okay. Glengarry Glen Ross. I went out with a girl named Gabby. I was doing a play here in Los Angeles called 6 Degrees of Separation by John Guare, directed by Jerry Zaks. It was very cool. All the New York actors came out. I was the only LA actor. I felt very cool. I was working there for 3 months here. We took it on tour. Great time. And I was dating a girl named Gabby who had her own car. It was a convertible. And she was just beautiful. She liked that I was an actor. She thought it was cool. She was a money little girl. And she picked me up at the theater. She picked me up in her convertible, always wearing a new low-cut top. I was just the biggest dick in the theater. I was like, look at me. I can't go out, guys. My girlfriend in the convertible is picking me up. So Glengarry Glen Ross is opening. And I say to her, let's go to Glengarry Glen Ross. She's like, great. That sounds fun. She has no idea what it is. We go. She picks me up in the car. We go to a late show after I get out of the theater one night. And we sit down and Glengarry Glen Ross starts. And that monologue comes on. And I am riveted. I am like, fuck, this is why I became an actor. This is so good. And I look over and Gabby is dead asleep. I mean, dead fucking asleep. Through the whole film, she sleeps. Yeah. And at that point, I was like, I never thought this could happen. But I am so now sexually turned off by you, because in my mind, the world comes down to there are those who fall asleep during Glengarry Glen Ross. And those who do not.
You reminded me of this story right there where I took this girl who was a model and she was about 6'6". I don't know how tall she was. She was a model and I took her to see the movie Once, which was incredible. I love the movie. I love the music from Once. And she didn't like it. She wasn't into it. And I loved it. I thought it was the greatest movie ever at the time. And then I was just like, I don't know if I can get with this girl. And then she leaned down to kiss me. I mean, I'm 5'11", but she leaned down to kiss me. And it was just such a boner killer that I couldn't handle it. And then I took this other girl I was dating to see Once and she loved it. And because I wanted to see it again. So I took another date to see the same movie. She absolutely loved it. We talked about it for hours afterwards. That's my wife. That's the woman I married. So... yeah.
God, Once has to be one of the greatest movies ever made.
The soundtrack's incredible. Yeah. It's so good.
I couldn't get up. I've seen that guy play probably 7, 8, 9 times. He's so good.
I'd love to see him live. I've never seen him. You know, Matthew talks about him all the time. He became buddies with him, you know, and used to hang out with him. But yeah, I'd love to see him live. They're incredible. Okay, so let's wrap it up. Patrick, thank you so much for coming on today. You were fucking amazing. You were amazing.
Appreciate it. Way to put the word out.
It's so great to see you. So great to see you. I'm going to send you a link to the class, too. I want you to try it out. I think you're going to...
Well, I give you my word that I will.
Did you like psychedelics?
Yes.
Then you'll like this class. It has a very similar feel to like taking psychedelics. There's like a whole trip aspect to it where like at the beginning you're like, oh, this is weird, this is uncomfortable, I don't like it, and then you're like, oh, I'm kind of liking this. I'm like, oh, like, oh my god, this is intense. Like, it has that same layers to it, and people say it's a lot like taking psychedelics. So now I think you'll probably try it after hearing that. Like, I'll probably
that's your lead, by the way.
Yeah That, and you do it laying down, so those two things combined. So thanks so much. We loved having you today.
Awesome. All right, guys. Great to see you.
Thanks. Great to see you.